high 36. Right now, wind west at 11. It's a chilly 29 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are dipping into the Morning Show archives to bring you a Morning Show conversation that was recorded and initially broadcast, I believe, back in 2010. Before we get to that, we want to remind you that tomorrow on the Morning Show, we have something very special, an on-air tribute to the late Norm McPhee, for many years managing and artistic director of the Racine Theatre Guild. He passed away earlier in November. There will be a tribute that features a number of different people who knew him well and worked with him extensively, including Joan Nissen, George Mangold, Mona Lewis, and Michael Klickner, as well as current managing and artistic director Doug Instanis. That will be tomorrow on the Morning Show. And there will be no Morning Show broadcast Thursday or Friday because of the Thanksgiving holiday. Our studios will be closed, but there will be a Morning Show podcast to enjoy both of those days and on through the weekend. To find the Morning Show podcast, be sure you look for the Morning Show with Greg Berg. Again, today's program comes from the Morning Show archives. On several different occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Kenosha's own Michael Schumacher. And before me, WGTD's Bill Guy, always loved the opportunity to speak with Michael Schumacher, who's written books on a host of different fascinating topics. I know that Bill talked with Michael about his book There But For Fortune, The Life of Phil Oakes. I've had the pleasure of speaking with him on about his book, Francis Ford Coppola, A Filmmaker's Life. We also talked about Mighty Fitz, the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and the wreck of the Carl D., a true story of loss, survival, and rescue at sea. His latest book is called Will Eisner, A Dreamer's Life in Comics. And it's certainly possible that you might not know the name Will Eisner. And even if you happen to be someone who likes comic books, you still might possibly not know this name. But Will Eisner is an absolute giant, a legend in the comics industry. And he was doing things well ahead of anybody else, and in particular was one of the first to really see the artistic potential at a time when others were just sort of churning out one comic after another without thinking very much at all about truly compelling stories or truly compelling artwork. And he's a fascinating man, that is Will Eisner. And Michael Schumacher's clearly had a wonderful time in gathering all kinds of information about him. And this is a handsome book, which includes a generous sampling of Mr. Eisner's artwork, which was done not only in the field of comics and comic books, especially with his most famous character that he created called the Spirit, but we also see examples of some of the work that he did for the military, in which cartooning was used to help train our soldiers, in particular, to be careful in matters of maintenance. And there's all kinds of things for us to talk about. So without further ado, Michael Schumacher, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You know, I am struck by how wide-ranging your topics are as I look down this list of all of the books that you have written, which also include a book about basketball, a book about writing, a book about Allen Ginsberg, a couple of different musician books. You are, it seems to be, mostly attracted to people who've demonstrated excellence and, in many cases, vision in what they've done.
I've always liked the idea of talking to people or writing about people who are kind of on the cusp in terms of the way they've been accepted and the way they're judged by the people in their various fields. In other words, Coppola was always kind of a maverick, and Allen Ginsberg was certainly a very controversial and very important figure, but the jury was always in and out on him. And so that was always something that worked for me. I like people who their lives also reflect their times or their business on a cutting edge. So these are things that were important to me, you know, when I was looking for a topic to write about. The range, I've done so many books at this point, and I still don't know whether or not having that range is a good thing or not, because if they can't put you in a nice little category or pigeonhole you, so to speak, they don't know what to do with you. The publicists and the reviewers and everything else, they look and they go, my God, this guy, he wrote a book about, you know, a basketball player, now he's writing about a comic book artist, or he's writing about a Beat Generation poet or whatever.
Or a shipwreck.
Yeah, how do you pin somebody down? I don't know, truly, to this day, whether or not that was the course to go. I'm glad I did, but as far as remuneration and so
right.
forth,
as a practical matter, it's maybe
exactly.
made things professionally a little tricky for you. But obviously, it's made you a happier writer because you've had such great things to write about, great people to write about.
Sure, I love to learn just as much as the next guy, I guess.
How did you come across the name of Will Eisner? Is he someone you've known about for a long time?
I've known about him for a long time, but not anywhere near. I had no idea when I took on this project what I was getting into. I've joked since the book's come out that this is sort of like the blind date you wind up marrying. You know, you don't know when you go into some of these projects what you're in for. I knew with, say, Allen Ginsberg what I was going, or that, say, the Fitzgerald book. You knew this story, so it was a matter of now trying to tell it well. Here, I had no idea going in that in examining this man's life that I would also be examining the really beginnings and history of the comic book and a graphic novel and so forth, because he was there from the very beginning.
Hmm. So that's something of a risk you were taking then. I mean, you got to work on a book not maybe fully knowing just how fascinating the story was going to be. I mean, hoping it would be, but not knowing for certain.
Sure. And then there was the incredible perk, if you want to call it that, of running into people that you've admired for a very, very long time. Meeting Jules Pfeiffer, actually sitting on a panel at the recent New York Comic Con with Jules Pfeiffer, was just a thrill for me. I've been reading his stuff since the late 60s, you know, or mid 60s. Some of these people, Stan Lee, the Marvel Comics creator and editor and spokesperson. He was one of my very first interviews that I did of a famous person way back in the 1970s. And here we come full circle. I'm interviewing him about his connection with Will Eisner and so forth. So for me, there's always that. You know, you always have this pleasant surprise with him.
So you tell us about Will Eisner's birth in New York City in spring of 1917, and you tell us that he ended up professionally being a real interesting amalgamation of who his mom was and his dad. I mean, a mixture of, in your words, a almost perfect combination of his parents' strongest traits, artistic dreamer and steely realist.
Absolutely. I'm not sure, had he come from another set of parents, any of this would have been possible. In other words, he had a great gift for art, but there are a lot of people out there, and when you look at their backgrounds, that are very gifted artists, but who are totally different. Eisner was a pioneer. Some of these others were not. Eisner realized early on that he had this talent that he wanted to take seriously and promote. That was his father. His father was lived in Vienna and was for a while and was an artist there, and moved to this country, and didn't have a lot of success. He worked for the Yiddish theaters in New York, and did background paintings. You know, paintings for backgrounds for theater. But he always wanted to be something else, and I've seen some of his paintings, and they weren't bad.
Mm.
Well, Will was encouraged by him, much to the dissatisfaction of his mother, who had seen the price that her husband had paid trying to. They were always broke. He was always moving from job to job. He had nothing. In fact, it got to the point where Will Eisner, as a teenage kid, was helping support the family by selling newspapers in New York City.
You tell us about this kind of disturbing moment when his mother says to Will, "Your dad's not making any money. You are the head of the house now." And he's 13 years old at the time.
Isn't that amazing? Oh. And this carried through for the rest of his life. His sister was the only member of his family to graduate from college. And it would not have happened except Will paid for her schooling all the way through. He paid for his parents, the rent on their apartment. He set up his younger brother, Pete. His real name was Julian, which was a kind of funny story about how he got the name Pete. But he set him up with work. Even after he could no longer employ Pete, he set him up. He had a connection with Dan and Yogurt, and he actually set him up with a job as a regional sales rep for Dan and Yogurt way back in the day. And so he felt that obligation all the way through to take care of his family because his mother had told him this. And that steeled him, so to speak, to this tremendous business acumen that he brought to a field. But really, they weren't known for their business people.
He was Jewish. This was a Jewish family. And you mentioned how a number of people in this the industry which he would enter were also Jewish, and many of them changed their names.
Yes.
To something a little less Jewish sounding, so to speak.
Well, and that's one of the things. It was like this sort of the Jewish immigrant experience, too, that kind of runs, flutters around in the background of this story. Yes, Jacob Kurtzberg became Jack Kirby, the incredible, renowned comic artist. Stanley Lieber became Stan Lee. And it wasn't just Jewish, although it was largely Jewish, mainly because the major publications that published, art were anti-Semitic in nature. So they had nowhere to go. They went to the same schools as some of these other artists. Everybody wanted to be the next Lion Decker why am I blowing it? The name of the guy from the Saturday Evening Post. I just did a
Norman
complete,
Rockwell.
Norman, thank you. For some reason, I did a complete blank. Everybody wanted to be that, but the Jews were not given that opportunity. And the comic business was largely created, and Danny Fingeroth, the wonderful writer and former comic book writer himself, wrote a scholarly study about this, about the idea that the comic artist, the superhero, had a lot of that Jewish experience behind it, the idea of, rising to the top, even though the odds were against you. It was pointed out that the Superman story was really the beginning of Superman, where he shot off into space as a baby, was the story of Moses. And so there's this interesting little tie-ins here. That came as a result of something nobody could control, and that was the anti-Semitism. They changed their names. They disguised their Captain America was nothing but a thumbing of the nose at Hitler. And so there are a lot of little tie-ins to this that might not have happened again if it had been something else. Although during World War II, Nicholas Viscardi changed his name to Nick Carty because he was tired of getting a lot of garbage about being Italian. So isn't it interesting how these things pan out?
Yeah, and the story behind America's Great Melting Pot is a little more complicated than it looks
from
a distance. We're talking with Michael Schumacher about his latest book, Will Eisner, A Dreamer's Life in Comics. So Will Eisner entertained himself as a youngster reading Pulp Fiction, mm-hmm. something which his parents had nothing but disdain for. It's one of the, you tell us, one of the only things they really agreed on. Briefly remind our listeners, some of whom might not remember or might not have ever really encountered this thing called Pulp Fiction, what it was, and then more importantly, what kind of inspiration it was for Will Eisner.
Well, really the pulp part of it was had to do with the nature of the publishing of the magazines. They used really nasty paper, and the fiction that was published in most of these magazines was genre, whether it was science fiction or romance or war stories. There were a whole bunch of different genres that they could write about. It was considered art for the masses in a very negative way, much the way comic books, certainly in the beginning, were seen as art for the masses in a negative way. Eisner, like most, in my opinion, intelligent creators, understood that the most important thing was the story. And these pulp magazines featured maybe not the greatest writing, the most artistic writing, although some of the great ones in the business started with Pulp Fiction. Hmm. But the story had to be there. And this was an interesting experiment for him because when he was reading this as a kid, he seemed to understand that you could tell good. So he loved O. Henry, was one of his favorites. And of course, the academics were pretty snarky about O. Henry for a long time. Or Ambrose Bierce. People had told interesting stories with the Stinger in the End or a surprise ending or things that moved along quickly, quick-paced, that entertained but also could tell you something.
Hmm. You write, from those pulps, or your quote, Eisner saying, from those pulps, I learned how to write short story material. I learned how to compress and structure a story. To this day, I choose the ending and write from the beginning to the end. So he gets, and you tell us that as a young man, he was not, for instance, much of an athlete, for instance, but this ability to draw was actually really important to him in terms of his own self-esteem and self-confidence and finding a place for himself, for instance, in school.
That's almost the archetype with these guys. It's really interesting. When I went back and interviewed a bunch of the Golden Age and Silver Age artists, they all seemed to have that. They weren't particularly good at this, but they were very good at that in terms of art. They may not have been the world's greatest athletes. Some of them, that was what made Jack Kirby so interesting, because he was this little pugnacious character who was really the child of the streets. A lot of them were, don't get me wrong. Jules Pfeiffer had a very similar experience growing up as Eisner did, in the respect that his mother was the one that ran the family. The father was just could not get it together. And don't forget, the Depression made a lot of fathers not get it together so well.
Right, right.
But, they grew up in similar neighborhoods, only a short distance from each other. And you understand how some of these things just shape people. You might not be able to hit a baseball, but you got a piece of chalk and you can draw. Right? Eisner, when he was young, was great with drawing airplanes and things like that. So you could draw. And people were always amazed by people who could do things that they couldn't. If you can't draw, you're amazed by it. If you can't write, I've always joked about that in my business. It's like I don't take it for granted, but it's not something that I give a lot of thought about, the actual act of writing. It's just something that I do, just like a plumber does what he does, or a barber does what he does, or whatever.
Things that we don't know how to do.
Yeah, exactly. So I do anyway. I admire people who can do things that I can't do, that I have to rely on to help me, a carpenter or something, anything,
Fascinating. So you tell us that Will Eisner, as he gets this first job distributing newspapers, really studied the comics that were not in the New York Times, but in all these other different newspapers, and more and more this becomes the field that is drawing him, and he is really interested in being both a practical matter of making a living and an artistic venture. So those two threads continue to run through his attitude.
I think that you made a very important point there. I think what separates the pioneers from the followers, if you will, is a sense of curiosity that the really great ones have. And I include that in all of the arts. I've been very lucky because some of the people I've written about had that curiosity. Ginsberg, it was endless. There was no end to his curiosity. Coppola, certainly a lot of curiosity too. It's like, well, what about this or what about that? Now, with
like
Eisner,
a restlessness.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And you're going to keep pushing, and that's what pushed Eisner first into the comic book, into doing The Spirit, which was an interesting experiment unto itself, to the graphic novel, which it, you know, there was no term graphic novel flying around out there, but the idea of let's take this to the next level. What would happen if? Would happen if? You know, and I think that's really what happens with the real pioneers. They're always stretching the limit.
Hmm. One of the interesting stories you tell, one of the things you mentioned that this story ends up being is about kind of a history of the comics and of when Will Eisner comes along. And we should just say a quick word about that. You tell us in the beginning comics were not intended to be highbrow entertainment, and that the comic book itself kind of emerges as a little bit of an accident. What do we need to know to kind of set ourselves up for Will Eisner's entry into this industry?
Well, the comic strip in newspapers was very, very important. At the turn of the century, even, comic strips sold newspapers. They would put on their delivery vehicles, whether it was carts or eventually vans, logos from comic strips and so forth, because they really, you know, for all the naysaying by the critics, you know, about them being cheap entertainment for the masses, they sold newspapers. Now, the reason that becomes important with Eisner is that after a while, some comic production companies started putting out comic books, which were just a gathering of what you'd already seen in newspapers, and for some reason, people would buy something they'd already read like that. Eisner rolls around, and it's a whole different game starting up. There were a number of other people in the field that created the original comic book. Eisner, seeing an opportunity, literally started his own production company, or a packaging company, if you will, with a guy named Jerry Iger. And they produced comic material, some stories just going a few pages, some longer, for comic books. And these companies would buy, they would say, we want something like this, or we want something like that, this kind of story, that kind of character. Or they created characters that some companies just ran from month to month. There really wasn't any Superman type thing until Superman itself. In other words, they didn't have a title of a character on the cover of the comic book. Well, when Siegel and Shuster, who created Superman, were just starting out, they brought their little adventure to Eisner and Iger, wondering if they could work for him and sell this. And Eisner looked at Superman and rejected, saying, I don't think anybody's going to be all that interested. You guys need a lot of work, you know, developing. And he would have to joke about that till his dying day, the day he turned down Superman.
One of the first and only bad professional misjudgments he committed in his long career. I mean, he had very good instincts for what the next big thing might be, but not in this case.
No, and who knew? You know, that was the thing. People liked adventure. They wanted this kind of story, that kind of story. When Eisner started The Spirit, it was an incredible adventure that's never again been duplicated, in the respect that they created a comic book, a 16-page comic book that was inserted into Sunday newspapers. and to the subscribers of this, the Spirit insert. And the Spirit, he didn't want to do superheroes. He didn't want to do people with fighting aliens from other places. He wanted to tell stories for adults as well as kids, which is not an easy thing to do sometimes. And so he creates this character who becomes this mass character, which to Eisner's dying day he hated, because he goes, here I am, here's your character. He never takes his mask off. You never see him without it. And it's like he's standing in a subway. No, that's not going to stand out much, right? or he's going to the grocery store, he's shopping, wearing his mask, you know, and his fedora and so forth. But the stories were amazing that he told. It was what caught people's eye. The Spirit so often wasn't even part of the story, other than he'd just make a sort of an appearance at some point or another in a story. He did adaptations of the Fall of the House of Usher, for example. The only time the Spirit's in that story is he's looking at the and he's going to start reading this story to someone else. So he wanted to do stories. He wanted to do stories that would appeal to adults. The comic book was not such a critter. So he had to literally kind of forge his way into that. You know, it was supposed to be entertainment for what they call the 12-year-old cretins from Kansas City.
Right.
There were some really intelligent people doing very intelligent work as well as, you know, the pass your time stuff.
Explain to our listeners who did what when it came to, for instance, the Spirit. I believe I'm right that kind of changed a little bit, or might even change, but in terms of who would write the story versus who would create the artwork. I mean,
exactly.
Will Eisner created the Spirit, but he was not responsible for everything.
Sure. Well, the comic book process, like so many other processes in art, is not as simple as people think.
In fact, at one point you call it, in these days, a bit of a hodgepodge kind of process.
It really is. You have a person that comes up with an idea for a story. Now, you could type those ideas out as you would a movie script. I've seen those, where it's literally like a movie script or a television script. Then, but one way or the other, you have to get this story told. Then you do what they call like a breakdown, where it's like, how many panels are we going to have? How's this thing going to break down? How are we going to tell this story? Sometimes that goes with the writing process, but you have to make sure you know you've got 8 pages to sell the story, or 4 pages, or however long. Then you pencil, rough pencils. You just take and draw almost. And some people like Pfeiffer used to do stick figures, just rough, so that you can see how you're going to walk through this thing. Then you start making more tighter pencils, so, you know, with a pencil. Then it starts to get interesting. Now you're starting to use ink. You have a person, that can be an entirely different person. The person writing the piece versus the person doing the penciling versus the person doing the inking can be all different people. Now they're starting to do some serious, you know, art. And then you have a colorist will come in and do colors. And even then, with all of this, you could have somebody who does just backgrounds. Eisner hired a guy who was great at buildings, just to do buildings. He hired a guy who could do animals, just to do animals, because he couldn't draw a dog to save his soul. So somebody come in and do the dog. Eisner wrote the stories, or co-wrote them later on with Jules Pfeiffer. Always did the breakdowns. Then it started to get interesting. He would do rough pencils generally, but he always drew the heads. This was an important thing. With other cartoon artists, too, I found. You can get somebody to do some of the action stuff and whatever, but you want the faces, you want certain things consistent all the way through. It seems funny to me that you would break this down that way, but that's what worked for them, because they were putting out such an enormous volume of product on a weekly basis. You were really running a real strong, tight shop, making sure things were getting passed around. And one of my favorite stories of the shop system was the guy named Lou Fine, who's one of the great giants in early. His stuff was. You could put it up on walls, and, you know, it was art. And people would sit around and wait for Lou's stuff to come in, you know, after Eisner had done his penciling. And Al Fine is getting down to, you know, doing the real, real intricate stuff on some of this. And people go, oh, my God. Or he would do work on other features, you know, that Eisner just say, okay, you take this and do whatever you wish with it. Although Fine didn't write. See, that was he was just an artist. Jack Kirby preferred not to write, although he did do some writing. He was much better at art. Other people were better writers. Neil Gaiman, the great graphic novelist, does no drawing to speak of. It's all written, you know, and he gets a partner to do the artwork for his stories. Again, going back full circle, if you don't have a story, none of the other stuff matters at all.
Right, and that was one of the things that Will Eisner understood very well. It all starts with the story. Say just a quick word about kind of the murky matter of copyright. Mm-hmm. And back in this day, this really bothered Will Eisner a lot, that it was an industry in which it was all but impossible for somebody who created a hero to, in a sense, own that hero themselves.
Well, that was the thing that he learned, again, the business part of it, he learned from his mother was, you know, I'm hanging on to the rights here. That was unheard of. When he negotiated to own the rights for the spirit, this was not, not only was that unheard of, it just, there were like two comic book artists, and I forget which ones there were. I know Milton Caniff, the guy who created Terry and the Pirates, and then went on to do Steve Canyon. He owned the rights. Al Capp, who did Lil Abner, went, I forget how many years, 15 years or so before he had the rights to his characters. The syndicates kept the rights. And so Eisner comes walking in and says, no, I'm not doing that. I own these characters. I'm creating them. I'm owning them. And that was a major step forward, not only for him, but for comics in general. He really sort of blazed the trail there. For their owning their material. It was unthinkable that they would return, the companies would give the artists their work back at the end. And Eisner was instrumental in fighting, certainly on behalf of Jack Kirby, to get back his original artwork. And he returned original artwork. So there are a lot of little political, almost, things that are going on here that politics behind the business. Well, if you do this, then we won't do that, or whatever. That he was looking at firsthand. There was no Bible out there, whatever you want to call it, to say here's how we do this, or a manual or whatever. He was making up the rules as he went along.
Fascinating. At some point, Will Eisner begins to, I don't know if grows tired or burns out or whatever. This is. It becomes more and more difficult and challenging for him to sustain the excellence with which he had begun. And World War II comes along, and he ultimately embarks, of course, on a military career, which ultimately sets in motion a second career for him doing cartooning for the military.
Yes.
Explain to our listeners what this legacy is all about.
Well, this was very, very important in his life. He believed very strongly that you could use what he called sequential art, you know. And what that is who knows. It's like when you talk about the graphic novel. When was the first graphic novel? Was that on a cave, painted in a cave somewhere? Certainly hieroglyphics, you know, the Egyptians were working in that kind of sequential art. Well, Eisner always saw it as you could use it for almost anything, as some of the people way in the past did. And the Army, what they found out with the Army was there was a very large percentage of people fighting in World War II, say, and then later on in Korea and Vietnam, who were barely literate. You couldn't teach these people things in manuals. A technical manual was an absolute mystery to them.
Anything with a lot of text.
Yes, but you could show this. And the preventive maintenance program that the Army instituted was a natural for Eisner to approach. he created a character called Joe Dope. Don't be a dope, you know, because Joe Dope was the GI who was always screwing up. But you got into technical things where he could show how things were done. He had a very interesting moment later on in his life when he was in Korea, where he ran across a guy and said, "You Will Eisner?" Because he would go out in the field to see these machines and so forth that he was writing about, illustrating. And Eisner says, "Yes, I am." He says, "You saved my ass."
Mm.
That's just the way he put it. And it turns out he had a situation occur out in the field where he had to do a field fix. And Eisner's had written about this in one of those little PS magazine supplements that the military put out. And it literally saved the guy. But on a more day-to-day basis, this was just a way to get the soldiers to do voluntarily what they might not do under or would complain about doing under orders.
Right, right. And it kind of did it with a slight spirit of fun. And like you said,
sure,
by the heavy use of pictures, it made it all the more effective. After the war, when he continues doing this for the military, it's also a very interesting time for the comic book industry.
Yes, it is.
There, this gentleman comes along by the name of Frederick Wortham, who believes strongly that rising juvenile delinquency is directly caused by the rise in comic books. And he sets in motion a movement to either stamp comic books out of existence or to heavily regulate their content and so on. It's most significant for the story of Will Eisner in the sort of new industry which this criticism fosters, namely this underground comic book movement.
Sure.
Tell us about that.
Well, Wortham and that story, I remember very specifically when I was a kid. They put that little stamp of approval. They called it the comic code, you know, stamp of approval on every comic book. And if it didn't have that, I wasn't allowed to read it. So, like, for Mad Magazine, when Mad Magazine was created in response to Wortham in the respect that not the content, but the format, they decided to go with a magazine format than a comic book format because they could avoid that stamp.
Right.
But a comic book was a comic book, and I wasn't kidding my parents with any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm,
and they weren't happy about this. Plus, I'm sure they thought the same thing, is that, you know, you're numbing your mind if you're reading a comic book. You should be reading something else. But Wortham, he was sort of a pop psychologist. He was a man of immense influence and a man of importance. His early work, there's no doubt in my mind that Wortham meant well. But then when he started to get a lot of press, he became sort of a Dr. Phil figure.
Right.
You know, where you're going, come on, how are we supposed to take this seriously? But you had to, because there was an industry, a lot of good people were run out of this business because of his going in front of Senate subcommittees and so forth, and just giving nothing but anecdotal evidence to support his case. It wasn't very, very good. He certainly wasn't much of a clinician there at the end, but it affected the business. Fortunately, Eisner was out of the comic book business at that point. But as you said, then you had these guys come around, the hippies, or even the pre-hippies, you know, the beat type figures, who just would thumb their noses at Wortham and say, "The hell with you." And out come the comic books.
So we have
comics with an X.
Right. So we have mainstream comics, COMICS, that play within these rules and very safe sort of comics, very G-rated. And then you have this whole other industry, COMIX.
Yeah.
And where some of the most interesting and innovative things start coming about. And, of course, a few years later, a decade or two later, Will Eisner hasn't produced a new story of the spirit in a long, long time, but certain people in the industry remember him well and his importance. Tell us how he kind of ends up entering the industry again.
Well, it was actually an accident. He was invited to a convention, one of the very early comic book conventions in New York, and he wasn't real up on doing this, but he got talked into it. And while he was there, he met Dennis Kitchen, who became his publisher. Dennis was a publisher of comics with an X. And by that, you know, people wonder what you're dealing with here. Some of the great comics artists from that time, underground artists, Robert Crumb, who, you know, created some of the most influential work, you know, in the later part of the 20th century, was a comics artist. You know, whether he was doing a cover of an album for Big Brother and the Holding Company, you know, for Cheap Thrills, or he was doing Mr. Natural or the Keep on Truckin' Boys or whatever. Then you had Art Spiegelman, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his comics when he did Mouse. These were extremely gifted people. There were, as there are in all fields, people that weren't all that good, you know, people that just passed through, weren't really dedicated to it, in and out, and that was it. But then you had the people, you know, that really, this was something that was important. Now, where does this affect Eisner? These guys were doing adult material. They were doing, whether it was funny, like Crumb doing Fritz the Cat, or it was serious. This was strictly for people. This wasn't for your teenage kids. And Eisner saw an opportunity here to continue something he had tried with the Spirit, only taking it to a whole new level. He wasn't interested in the sexually explicit stuff that some of them were doing, or the drug stuff that some of them. He was at that time, he was a middle-aged man, you know, but he was actually approaching old age. And so he built, after meeting Dennis, he said, I want to do something here. And so they started doing reprints of the old Spirit comic books and things like that. But what was more important to Eisner was what was stewing in his mind about the potential for taking this sequential art form to another adult level. He dreamed of being in bookstores. He dreamed of being in libraries. How can I do that? And what worked for him, and it's still an amazing work of art when you see it to this day, was his daughter died of leukemia when she was a teenager. She was 16, I believe.
16, yes.
And it was horrible. And he carried this anger about all this with him for a while, and all of a sudden decided, after meeting Dennis and discussing possibilities and so forth, to write not about that, but about that anger that he felt. He felt that, listen, if I lead a good life, this was sort of well, it's not just Jewish. I think it's across the board, pretty much. You lead a good life, and you're going to be rewarded. And he tried to live a good life. He had lived a good life. And all of a sudden, he lost one of the things that was most precious to him, and he was angry. And he felt like a contract had been violated here. And so he wrote a book called A Contract with God, which addressed that. That was one of four stories, the longest and the most memorable of four, like novellas, in this one little cover package. And when it came out, he was trying to market the thing. And nobody, how do you market this? Nobody had ever heard of such a thing before. Even though you had, what's a graphic novel? Is that Classics Illustrator where they do, you know, Moby Dick? I mean, you could go almost anywhere with what a graphic novel was. But there would have been no, you know, blueprints done. Now he goes and he tries to market this, and everybody's going, sorry, it's a comic book. Yeah. So he met with a very small publishing house, put some of his own money into it, comes out with a contract with God, and it absolutely blew the ceiling off of everything. It reinvented the form. Now, you know, because everything you're looking at now is stemming from those very early days when these people were doing that.
And, of course, even a lot of standard comic books are more like graphic novels than they ever were before. It changed everything.
Well, you must have read the comic books when you were a kid that continued from one issue to the next. Is what made you keep buying that particular title.
Sure. No story ever ended.
Yeah. Totally. So at what point does that become a graphic novel? You know, in other words, when Frank Miller did his Batman stuff, you know, the Dark Knight series,
yes,
they weren't comic books, tiny comic books, but they were individual shorter things that were gathered to become the Dark Knight books. And you felt like
you held a self-contained marvelous story with a beginning and a middle and an end, and a fully satisfying artistic
character
experience.
Development. There were you could start to do with a graphic novel even more than you could do with a comic book. Now you could start doing things where you could mix in all sorts, like The Watchmen, that graphic novel, which I'm telling you, you want to read that, you're going to have to devote some time to it.
Hmm.
You start bringing in other elements of art and of literature and so forth, where song lyrics are all of a sudden becoming part of, certainly in The Watchmen, Dylan and such. But Eisner, in his stuff, A Life Force, he had weather reports, he had news clippings. They were always trying to push this to what can we do that's going to make this even more realistic. Even though we're dealing with something that is drawn, let's make people really believe it.
Give it this kind of vivid potency.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's an amazing story about all that he accomplishes over the course of so many decades of this long, fascinating career. And, we need to tell people again the name of the book and really encourage people, even if you have no interest in comics, to read this story, because it's one of the great American success stories.
It is, yeah. And it does tell you something about our times, too.
Absolutely.
All the way through it.
Absolutely. And from the days of the Depression to the McCarthy era to the 60s to the 70s, a lot of where we have come as a nation and a culture, we also find reflected in the story of Will Eisner. The title of the book again, Will Eisner, A Dreamer's Life in Comics. It is published by Bloomsbury. Again, it is generously pointed with all kinds of illustrations, including some full-color examples of Will Eisner's spectacular artwork. And the author, Michael Schumacher. Michael Schumacher, this has been so much fun. I love the book, and I'm so glad we got to have this conversation.
It always goes so fast, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? But thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And this is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. The time is exactly 9 o'clock. Actually, the time is 8:57. That interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. Tomorrow on the morning show, something extra special. We're going to be paying tribute to Norm McPhee, who from 1969 to 2001 served as managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild, and among other things, helped oversee the Guild's move to its current home. We have a tribute that is all set to go, which will feature commentary from 5 different people who knew him well and worked with him extensively. Joe Nissen, George Mangold, Mona Lewis, and Michael Klickner, along with current managing and artistic director Doug Instaness. That tribute will air tomorrow on the morning show. We want to remind you that there will be no morning show broadcast on Thursday or Friday because the studios of WGTD will be closed for the Thanksgiving holiday. But Thursday and Friday, there will be a morning show podcast and on through the weekend. In fact, all year long to enjoy the morning show 7 days a week, you should subscribe to the morning show podcast. Be sure that you look for the morning show with Greg Berg. It's available anywhere you listen to podcasts. Today is going to be sunny, breezy, and chilly. Today's high just 38 degrees. Overnight low of 28 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, mostly cloudy. Actually, a 30% chance of rain or snow flurries. A high tomorrow of 43 degrees. Looks like Thanksgiving Day is going to be chilly as well. Under partly to mostly cloudy skies, a high of just 36 degrees. Even colder over the weekend. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, under mostly sunny skies, our daytime highs will only be in the upper 20s. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha.